Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine. What I Know Now, The Roots of Henry Louis Gates. The acclaimed Harvard professor has touched countless souls with his hit PBS series that traces the genealogies of well-known Americans. Here, he shares his own story. And this is as told to Joel Stein. Some public intellectuals win their place in society through fierce debate, showing off the sharpness of their minds during verbal attacks. But Henry Louis Gates, Jr. took a slightly different path. He did it by being charming. Gates, who bouncily introduces himself as Skip, is a charismatic everyman who just happens to be smarter than almost everyone else. Arguably the world's foremost scholar of African-American literature, Gates has helped expand the canon of American literature taught at universities to include black authors such as Zora Neale Hurston and Ralph Ellison. He has, more than any other scholar in the U.S., ensured that black culture and literature are not only preserved but disseminated throughout America in every which way, books, movies, television, and continued scholarship. And at 73, he's creating more popular work than ever. The 10th season of his PBS celebrity genealogy show, Finding Your Roots, launches in January and features Valerie Bertinelli, LeVar Burton, Michael Douglas, Dionne Warwick, and Sammy Hagar. Parentheses, AARP is a corporate supporter of this season of the show. End of parentheses. A month later, PBS is airing Gospel, Gates' four-hour documentary on that quintessential American music. The month after that, his book, The Black Box, Writing the Race, will provide a home version of his Harvard intro course on African-American studies. Here, in a wide-ranging and exclusive interview, Gates recounts the path that led him to his influential perch. The power of work. My father worked two jobs, at the paper mill and as a janitor at the telephone company. The phone company was a small office with six operators. They loved my father. We never had a phone bill. And because he had two jobs, we were the most prosperous black family in Piedmont, West Virginia. My brother and I would start looking at the Sears Roebuck catalog in July for our Christmas presents, and I got pretty much whatever I wanted. After Christmas, we were asked to bring in our favorite new toy to school. It took me years to realize that was patently unfair. When I was 13, I started buying Christmas presents for about 12 kids in the neighborhood. It was a practice motivated by a sense of privilege and guilt. My dad would go to his second job at 5 o'clock and get home at 7:30. Every evening, he would read the paper and do the crossword. He subscribed to Alfred Hitchcock's magazine. He read more books in his life than I'll ever read in mine. But I have replicated my father's life, doubled. I have probably four jobs. I have a 7-day work week, and I love it. My mother went through a very severe menopause. One Sunday, when I was 12 years old, they were taking Mom into the hospital, and my mother told me she was going to die. I went up to my bedroom, I cried, and I made a deal with Jesus that if he let my mother live, I would give my life to Christ. On Wednesday, she came back from the hospital. That following Saturday, I hitchhiked 5 miles away to the county area, to the county seat. I walked into the service at the Black Methodist Church. The average age was like 95. There's a call to the altar, if you want to give your life to Christ. So I stood up, and everybody in the church got around me. They asked five questions, and you say, I do. I cried. Everybody cried. It was one of the most moving things ever. That night, I was so nervous through dinner. I knew my parents would not like this. Joining that church meant I could not go to basketball games. I couldn't dance. I couldn't play cards. And I said, I joined the church today. They went crazy. I never told them why I did it. I thought that would be a violation of the agreement I had with God. So for 2 years, I didn't go to basketball games. I didn't dance. I didn't play cards. Everybody in that church thought I was going to be a preacher. But I had the same brain then as I have now. I began to feel like a hypocrite because I was worshiping with people who thought the world was created in 7 days, and that there actually was a man and a woman named Adam and Eve. During the first decade of the 20th century, my great-grandparents sent their 3 girls to Howard University. They kept the oldest boy on the 200-acre Gates farm. They didn't educate him, which really pissed him off. I don't think he ever forgave his parents or his sisters. I descended from the guy who stayed and ran the farm with his father. And that guy made sure that his children and grandchildren would be educated. I can't remember ever suspecting I was not going to college. The only question was which medical school I was going to. At the Peterkin Church camp in West Virginia in the summer of 1965, I asked the editor of the camp newspaper where he went to school. I wrote to Exeter and was interviewed by William Campbell, a famous golfer. I got a free ride to Exeter, but I dropped out after 6 weeks. I was homesick. I wrote Exeter in my senior year of high school and asked if I could come for a postgraduate year, increasing his chance of admission to a selective university. I was sure they would take me. They didn't. I hadn't applied any other places, so I went to Potomac State College. I threw myself into pre-med my freshman year. I got straight A's. I was going to be a doctor in Piedmont, he laughs. But I had a great English teacher there who persuaded me to apply to Yale and drop pre-med. So I did, and went to Yale on a scholarship. When I left for Yale, my father said, "If they don't treat you right, come on home." And I cried, because that was so empowering. It meant that our opinion of you is not based on the judgment of some anonymous people 424 miles away, whether they went to Yale or not. I knew that Time magazine had hired Strobe Talbot, a fellow Yalie, and later President Clinton's Deputy Secretary of State in London, when he got his Rhodes Scholarship. So when I got the Mellow Fellowship to go to Cambridge, I wrote Time seeking for a job. One of my best friends at Yale was Kit Luce, Time Inc. co-founder, Henry Luce's grandson. He sent it right to the chief of correspondence. I came down for an interview in London, and the next day they called me and said, "You have a job." I would call my parents and say, "You see those 3 sentences in this article? I wrote those." When I came back from testifying for the rap band 2 Live Crew in their 1990s obscenity trial, I was told I had embarrassed Duke University, where he taught at the time. That cut me to the quick because I had gone there to defend the First Amendment. Right after that, Harvard called and asked me to come up to give a talk. I knew I was being considered for a job there. The room was packed. First question, "Why did you testify for 2 Live Crew?" And I said, "Of all the people who talk dirty in the United States, 2 black guys get arrested? That's racist. I will always stand up and fight racism and fight for freedom of expression." People went crazy, and I got the job as chair of the Department of African American Studies. The band was acquitted, by the way. I conceived of the original version of Finding Your Roots around Alex Haley's roots. I only did black people. The narrative arc was constructed so that the apex would be when the guests found out what ethnic group they were from in Africa. "I thought that's when they would go crazy," PBS said. "We think this series is for everybody. My mistake was to assume everybody but black people knew their family tree. But nobody knows their family tree. Most people know their grandparents, but some people don't even know that." I had the same tailor on Seville Road make suits since 1998. I have 70 suits and sports coats. I wear 22 each season of Finding Your Roots. I have a couple hundred ties and pocket squares. We don't repeat. I have a custom-made closet. It's my closet. My wife is not allowed in my closet. Laughs. My wife and I eat dinner at 8. We generally stream a show during dinner. We're watching The Diplomat. I love it, but I'm an Anglophile. When I'm tired, I go to bed. If that's at 8 o'clock, it's 8 o'clock. I work hard, and I have a lot going on, but I sleep 8 hours a night and I sleep like a baby. Again, this article is as told to Joel Stein, who is an LA-based journalist and author of In Defense of Elitism and Man-Made. Now, we have a small inset here with this. Forward Momentum. 1973, graduated from Yale with a history degree. 1979, earned a PhD in English literature from Cambridge. 1979, named assistant professor in English and Afro-American studies at Yale. 1981, discovered Our Nig, the first published novel, 1859, by an African-American woman, awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant that same year. 1985, mentored Jodie Foster in her undergrad thesis on Toni Morrison. 1989, joined Duke as an English professor. 1990, defended the rap group Two Live Crew in an obscenity trial. 1991, appointed director of Harvard's Center for African and African American Research. 1992, received George Polk Award for New York Times op-ed essay. 1998, became the first African-American scholar to be awarded the National Humanities Medal. 2009, after his arrest for unlocking his stuck front door, had a beer with the arresting officer at the White House with Obama. 2012, began hosting PBS's Finding Your Roots with guest LeVar Burton, above in the picture here. And 2013-14, won Emmy and Peabody Award for the PBS documentary series The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. Now, moving back to AARP The Bulletin and their cover story, which we started last time, The Future of Alzheimer's. Why doctors have new hope about this disease and what that means for you. So our next question here is, why is this so difficult? Across the pharmaceutical industry, up to 90% of all experimental medicines that reach clinical trials don't make it to market, either because they don't work or they have bad side effects. Alzheimer's drug research has an even higher failure rate. From 2004 to mid-2021, 98 experimental Alzheimer's drugs failed in later-stage human studies. More were abandoned in labs or early human trials. Not a single new drug for Alzheimer's was approved by the FDA for nearly 18 years. Among the research community, people were despondent. It was like a clinical depression across the field. One major obstacle had been the historical difficulty of diagnosing Alzheimer's. Brain scans have shown that 17 to 22% of participants in Alzheimer's studies in the recent past did not have amyloid plaque and may not have actually had the disease, and 36% of failed phase 3 drug trials from 2004 to 2021 didn't test participants for the presence of amyloid plaques or tau tangles, meaning their cognitive problems could have been due to something else. You're never going to get a positive result when you've got the wrong people in the trial, says Catherine Mummery, head of clinical trials at University College London's Dementia Research Center. Another major issue, researchers may have been too narrowly focused on one culprit. One quarter of the failed drugs were aimed at amyloid plaques, globs of protein in the brain, that were first spotted 117 years ago by German psychiatrist Alois Alzheimer in the brain of a woman with severe dementia. Since these sticky blobs were the defining feature of the disease, it made sense that they were the primary target of researchers. The reason we've been so focused on plaques for so long is that they really stand out as soon as you look at the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, said Kyle Traviglia, a scientist at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle, where he is part of a team creating an atlas cataloging how thousands of different types of brain cells are changed in Alzheimer's disease. You see these giant ugly balls all over the brain. It wasn't unreasonable to look at them initially, yet drug after drug developed to target the amyloid plaques, most notably aducanumab, an earlier drug similar to lecanemab that was recently discontinued failed to show any clear impact on the cognitive decline of patients. Lecanemab is the first to show even modest success. Donanemab, which also clears amyloid plaques and slows disease progression, is expected to reach full FDA approval this year, and researchers are beginning to look at using focused ultrasound to open the blood-brain barrier and amp up the effectiveness of anti-amyloid drugs. In January, a West Virginia University study of three people that combined focused ultrasound with drug infusions removed more amyloid than the drug alone. Other theories about what triggers Alzheimer's are getting more attention, and drugs that target culprits other than amyloid are moving into early and late-stage human trials. In 2016, 56% of disease-modifying Alzheimer's drugs in human studies were aimed at amyloid plaques. By 2023, of 141 treatments in human trials, 84% were not for amyloid. Phillips says the intensity and variety of research and lessons learned during years of frustration should lead to faster progress. Targeting amyloid is significant, he says, but it's not the whole story. There's a growing consensus that several factors might work together to cause the disease. Researchers continue to study amyloid plaques, but other human trials are underway on drugs designed to reduce brain inflammation, protect synapses, parts of brain cells that communicate with each other, and improve aspects of brain metabolism, such as processing blood sugar, the brain's preferred fuel. In particular, researchers are taking a harder look at tau tangles, globs of protein that form inside the brain cells themselves. One medicine attracting a lot of attention is called BIIBO80. In a trial led by Mummery at the University of College London, it was the first anti-tau drug to successfully remove these damaging protein tangles from brain cells in a human study. Tau tangles in the brain seem to mirror much closer to the cognitive symptoms people have, Bateman says. A lot of us think that's a clue. If we could neutralize tau, people's symptoms could be better managed. At the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, a study called the Alzheimer's Tau Platform recently won a $151 million grant from the National Institutes of Health, NIH, to test two anti-tau drugs plus an anti-amyloid drug that will be given together to 900 people with early-stage disease. At a certain point with amyloid accumulation, tau gets sparked like a forest fire that really starts to do damage. On a different front, Finnish researchers launched a study that combines brain-healthy lifestyle steps with metformin, a diabetes drug that might improve blood sugar processing in the brain. The study will look at the effects of lifestyle plus the medication in the people at risk for Alzheimer's and dementia who do not have thinking and memory problems. The brain is only 3% of the body weight, but uses 20 to 25% of the body's energy, mostly from glucose, Phillips explains. Trouble absorbing blood sugar, called insulin resistance, increases with age. If the brain is deprived of energy, neurons can die, says Phillips, whose foundation helps fund the study. We want to see if the combination would have more benefit than either one alone. Having drugs against these various factors, Phillips says, means that within 10 years, customized multi-drug treatments will likely be prescribed based on a simple blood test. An analogy would be our approach to treating heart disease, which might involve cholesterol medications, blood pressure pills, blood sugar controls, dietary changes, or a combination of these treatments. We are starting to give combination drugs in trials, Mummery says. I believe that in 10 years' time, we will have blood biomarkers that give a fingerprint of what your disease looks like. We will be able to use that to define an individualized treatment regime. we'll be thinking about brain health in terms of prevention more than just dementia symptoms. I'm an optimist, she adds. We have a foundation. Once you have that foundation, research can accelerate. And here's a little sidebar about the BIIBOB-B080 drug. It's an investigational anti-tau drug that successfully removed the toxin protein from brain cells. Now, this article continues, and we will continue with it next time. Now, let's go back to AARP, the magazine, and look at some movies for grown-ups. 2024 Awards, Meet the Winners. Many of the films honored in the 23rd AARP Movies for Grown-Ups Awards dramatize real people and events. This article is by Tim Appello. Best Picture, Killers of the Flower Moon. At the peak of his powers, Martin Scorsese, 80, directs his most historically important gangster film about the Osage Native Americans exiled to a patch of Oklahoma considered worthless until they struck oil and a family of four's income increased by almost $1 million a year in today's dollars. Then a wily cattleman, Robert De Niro, devised a scheme to get men to marry Osage women and murder them in order to steal their oil rights money. Lily Gladstone is radiantly tragic as the Osage bride nearly killed by her greedy Dem husband, Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a master class in acting by a trio of top talents, De Niro, 80, DiCaprio, 49, and Gladstone, 37. Best Director, Christopher Nolan, for Oppenheimer. Why is a brainy three-hour epic about father of the atomic bomb, J. Robert Oppenheimer, starring the brilliant Cillian Murphy, 47, from Peaky Blinders and Disco Pigs, the highest-grossing biopic and also the top World War II film of all time? Because Nolan, 53, tells a riveting tale about an unstable, womanizing, neurotic genius whose terrible invention prompted Japan's surrender. And he does so in an eye-popping style that takes us deep into a fascinatingly maze-like mind. Nolan made The Dark Knight, the greatest Batman movie. Now, incredibly, he's made an anti-superhero blockbuster. Director John Waters calls Oppenheimer a big-budget, star-studded, intelligent action movies about talking. Next is Best Actor, Colman Domingo, Rustin. Civil rights leader Bayard Rustin was 51 when he and A. Philip Randolph organized the 1963 March on Washington, then the biggest peaceful protest in U.S. history. He challenged Martin Luther King Jr. to go there and address the crowd. The event, which featured King's I Have a Dream speech, helped inspire the epical Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And Domingo, now 54, was 51 when filming took place, proof that age is no obstacle when it comes to changing history or immortalizing on film a character who's been almost totally erased from history because he was gay. Domingo captures Rustin's electrifying charisma, droll wit, intellectual firepower, and personal pains, from the tooth a cop knocked out when he dared to take a bus seat to the cruel disrespect he received from civil rights colleagues. And we have a comment here from Colman Domingo on Rustin. We're in a dark moment in our history, especially with young people. They feel hopeless. You need someone who is a Pied Piper to inspire people to be their full selves, to use their minds, hearts, and bodies, to create the world they want to live in. We need to create a new generation of angelic troublemakers. Now we have Best Supporting Actor Robert De Niro, Killers of the Flower Moon. De Niro has never created a more chillingly brilliant performance than his turn as William King Hale, the real-life monster and self-made businessman who posed as the best friend the Osage ever had in Oklahoma, building them schools and hospitals while secretly having them poisoned, shot, and bombed to line his pockets and those of his crime ring. Best actress is Annette Bening from Naiad. Bening, 65, didn't permit a stunt double to do a single stroke in her movie about Diana Nyad, who at 64, after a few well-publicized failures to do so, successfully swam from Havana to Key West, braving jellyfish, the elements, and her own demons. Bening trained daily for a year with Olympic swimmer Retta Owen, but it was her acting chops that brought Nyad alive on screen. When the film alternates real footage of Nyad with Bening, it seems like the same person, the kind of athlete even a shark might hesitate to cross. It had to be said, if there were an Olympics for acting, Bening would take the gold. Best Supporting Actress, Jodie Foster for Nyad. If you thought Jodie Foster, 61, was tough in The Silence of the Lambs, wait until you see her as Diana Nyad's coach, Bonnie Stoll. Her performance is crucial, because the film's not just the story of one determined athlete, but a buddy picture about Nyad's relationship with the salt-of-the-earth friend and trainer who got her through personal and physical storms. Bening was grateful for Foster's longer acting experience, 57 years versus her 43, and like Nyad and Stoll, they've now triumphed together as Movies for Grown-Ups Award winners. Foster said she took the part to show the world that older women could be, as she put it, badasses. And indeed, she did. Annette Bening, we have a sidebar article on her comment. So much of our industry is geared towards getting young kids into the theater, and there's a place for that. But many of us want stories that get us in our gut, that are for adults. We need that. It's why I got into movies. The power of a good story. And finally for today, best screenwriter Noah Baumbach with Greta Gerwig for Barbie. Naturally, director Gerwig, 40, gets the lion's share of glory for the $1.45 billion blockbuster, not her co-writer and husband, Baumbach, 54. She signed the deal to write the screenplay together without telling him. At first, Baumbach pleaded, "You gotta get us out of this." But when they started writing, confident that nobody would let them actually film something so strangely funny and full of pop culture in-jokes, they had a blast. The Barbie-Ken tensions are doubtless informed by their own relationship as authors, whose Marriage Story, directed by Baumbach, and Little Women, directed by Gerwig, competed for Oscars in 2020. Baumbach defended Barbie against critics who called it satire of Ken anti-man, saying, "I felt men could take it, and only one man could help make it." Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.